make it there. And I thank the organizers for letting me give this talk remotely. So slide two, please. So there's the outline. I'm going to give you a very brief review of inflation. Since this is a specialist audience, it's going to be very quick and technical. I'll then tell you about work on clustering fossils, which is actually the so-called B-modes for galaxy surveys that's discussed or mentioned in the title. I'll then tell you about recent work about tensor fossils from inflation, which is relevant in particular for this gravitational wave signal that we're so interested to hear about now. And at the end, I'll tell you very quickly about a new way to get B modes from tensor fluctuations without producing any temperature fluctuations or E modes whatsoever. Next slide, please. So before I proceed, these are the people who did most of the work. Some of the work, I'll tell you, was done with other collaborators, but most of it is done with Donggui Jiang, who until 2 weeks ago was a postdoc at Johns Hopkins and has just started a junior faculty position at Penn State. And Liang Dai is a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, close to the end of his third year. Next slide, please. So here is my summary of inflation. Inflation involves the introduction of a scalar field phi of x. Fluctuations in that scalar field produce a curvature perturbation, which we call zeta of x. That is, gives rise to or is equivalent to a density perturbation delta of x through a Poisson equation. And then some people talk about the gravitational potential phi of x, which is the same thing as zeta of x up to a factor of 5/3. And the important thing for now is that all of these are scalar fields and all of them are interchangeable. If I know the inflaton fluctuation, I know the curvature, the potential, and density perturbation. And so I'm going to use those terms interchangeably. So next slide, please. There we go. So the inflationary predictions. So inflation doesn't tell us what the value of phi of x is, but it does make a prediction for the distribution of the Fourier amplitudes. So first we construct this phi twiddle of k, the Fourier amplitude, and specification of phi twiddle is equivalent to the specification of phi of x and vice versa. And the prediction of inflation is in that second line where we define the power spectrum piece of phi of k. And the prediction is that the variance of phi, or the expectation value for the amplitude of phi squared, is equal to the power spectrum. And if we're talking about two different Fourier modes, k not equal to k prime, the expectation for the product of those two Fourier modes is zero, and that's the Kronecker delta in front of the power spectrum. So inflation predicts that the different Fourier modes are statistically independent. And the lowest order approximation in which they're Gaussian. Gaussianity makes a number of predictions for the higher endpoint correlation functions. So the next two lines show what those are. And Gaussianity says that the expectation value for the product of any three Fourier modes is zero if n is odd. Sorry, for any number of Fourier modes that's odd. And if the number of Fourier modes is even, for example, if there are four Fourier modes, then the expectation value of that of the product of those four Fourier modes can be written as a sum over products of power spectra of the scalar field. Or in the language of particle physics, the prediction is that the four-point and higher endpoint correlation functions are disconnected. This is a consequence of the Lagrangian for inflation, which is given towards the bottom of the page, S equals integral d4x squared minus g, and then the rest of that is the Lagrangian. The first term is the Einstein-Hilbert action for the gravitational field, the second term is the kinetic term for the scalar field, and the third term is the potential for the scalar field. And if we expand this Lagrangian in the curvature amplitude, or equivalently the scalar field amplitude, then roughly speaking, this action can be written as a sum of independent Fourier modes. And the Lagrangian for each Fourier mode is equivalent to the Lagrangian for a simple harmonic oscillator. And that tells us that the amplitudes of each of these Fourier amplitudes is selected from a Gaussian distribution. And it also tells us that each of these Fourier amplitudes are statistically independent. And that is represented as a propagator in the language of quantum field theory, which is that line at the bottom of the page. But then, and the line, the second from bottom of the page, there is that last term, order zeta cubed. And so in the lowest order approximation, we assume that's negligible, but that's where all the action for this talk is going to be. So next slide, please. So there are, in fact, though, cubic corrections to the lowest order action, even if the potential is equal to zero. And the reason that occurs is that the gravitational, the metric, g mu nu, has a number of degrees of freedom, and it can be decomposed into scalar, tensor, and vector degrees of freedom. And the scalar fluctuation phi mixes with the scalar modes, phi and psi, of the metric perturbation. So even in the absence of any potential, there are going to be cubic terms, and those give rise to departures from Gaussian entity in primordial perturbations. So one way to describe this, very common way to describe the lowest order departure from Gaussian entity, is the three-point correlation function, or the expectation value for three Fourier amplitudes, delta of K1, K2, K3. And that expectation value is non-zero only if K1 plus K2 plus K3 are zero. That's a consequence of translational invariance. In quantum field theory, or the language of cosmology, that's a consequence of statistical homogeneity. And the product, in the case that K1 plus K2 plus K3 is equal to zero, is the bispectrum B, which is a function of the magnitudes K1, K2, and K3 of the three Fourier modes being correlated. So this was shown, this has been known for a long time. It was demonstrated most clearly and correctly in this classic paper by Maldacena from 2002. And one of the consequences of that calculation and others like it is that this bispectrum is non-zero in standard single field slow roll inflation, but it's small. Probably unobservably small. But over the past decade or more, there has been a huge literature of models that involve the investigation of new physics beyond that presented in standard single field slow roll inflation. And so this bispectrum may actually be bigger in beyond SFSR inflation models. So there are a whole list of models which I didn't even attempt to include in that very brief list there. So next slide, please. So this is a pictorial description of the bispectrum in the language that cosmologists like to use. So the bispectrum correlates three Fourier modes, wave numbers K1, K2, K3 that have to add up to zero. And so the bispectrum is a function of the triangle shape and magnitude. And if the physics is statistically isotropic, the bispectrum does not depend on the orientation of that triangle in three spatial dimensions. Next slide, please. And for the particle physicists, the way that three-point function is represented is as a Feynman vertex. So those lines are three Fourier modes of the scalar field, and that's the three-point correlation function. So that is a brief lightning review of much of what has happened in cosmology over the past decade. But there is more that standard single-field slow-roll inflation models predict, and also more that models for beyond single-field slow-roll inflation may also predict. So even in standard single-field slow-roll inflation, the Lagrangian contains that kinetic term shown at the top of the slide. And that kinetic term involves the contraction of a metric tensor with gradients of the scalar field. And that metric tensor is approximately a de Sitter metric during inflation plus a perturbation, h mu nu. And so there is going to be a term in Lagrangian that looks like an hij di phi dj phi, if I'm just looking at the spatial components. So as a consequence, there is a tensor scalar bispectrum that arises even in single field slow roll inflation. So this is a correlation between the gravitational waves produced during inflation that we've been hearing all about the past few weeks, and the density perturbations that we've known and loved and seen and measured precisely with WMAP and Planck and other experiments for well over a decade. So this was one of the things that was pointed out in this paper by Maldacena in 2002. And one of the consequences, so the line below that, there's an expectation value of three Fourier amplitudes. One is for H, so there's an H sub capital K superscript S. That is the Fourier amplitude of a gravitational wave of Fourier wave number capital K, and S is the gravitational wave polarization, which can be plus or cross. And then there are two Fourier modes for the density field, delta K1 and delta K2. And the prediction of the in Maldacena's paper is that there's a three-point correlation function for those three Fourier amplitudes. It's proportional to a Dirac delta function. So it's non-zero, again, only if the three Fourier wave numbers add up to zero, a consequence of translation invariance. Then there is an epsilon ij superscript s. That's a polarization tensor for that Fourier wave vector, and s can again be plus or cross. And then that is dotted into K1 and K2. So that tells us the tensorial dependence of the three-point correlation function on the direction of the scalar Fourier modes with respect to the polarization tensor of the gravitational wave. And then there is a tensor scalar-scalar bispectrum, B sub T SS, which is a function of those three wave numbers, capital K for the gravitational wave, and K1 and K2 for the density perturbations. So again, at the bottom of the page, we see a pictorial representation as a triangle in the language of cosmologists, and in the language of particle physicists, there's a three-point function that includes one gravitational wave or graviton and two scalar field modes. Next slide, please. So it's also conceivable. I don't have any model in particular, so if you ask, you may be disappointed. But it's conceivable that somebody might think up a model in which there is a vector field. Actually, there are models that I can think of. Such things can arise in gauge and chromonatural or solid inflation models, as the little comment at the bottom of the page has reminded me. Anyway, you might surmise that inflation involves the introduction of some new vector field which somehow couples to the scalars. So if you have a terminal Lagrangian that looks like the one at the top of the page that gives rise to a vertex like the one shown there, three-point function with a V and a phi and a phi, and that could affect primordial density fluctuations. It's also plausible that in addition to the inflaton phi, there could be another scalar field during inflation, a spectator scalar field, which I call xi of x. And there is a concrete example of this. There are SUSY models for inflation by Bauman and Green, for example, plenty of other examples. And as the diagrams show there, if there's a three-point function that correlates two phis with a xi, then by exchange of a virtual xi, there's a four-point function for the phis. So three-point function here gives rise to a correlation of two phis with a xi gives rise to a phi four-point correlation function, even if all other observational consequences of xi vanish after inflation. And it's also conceivable that there might be some spectator spin 2 field during inflation that is not necessarily the graviton, in which case there could be a term in Lagrangian that couples that spin 2 field, T mu nu, to two scalar field terms, D mu phi, D nu phi. And that can occur, for example, in models like gauge, chromonatural, or solid inflation models, and perhaps others. So next slide, please. So this is the meat of the of this part of the talk. So Donghui Jiang and I wrote this paper 2 years ago where we showed how it is that you would look for evidence of coupling of the inflaton to some new field during inflation. And we also showed how it is that you could take something like a galaxy survey and not only look for this coupling, look for evidence of inflaton coupling to some new field, but you could also, with a galaxy survey, distinguish geometrically whether that new field was a scalar vector or tensor field. So the way it works is given by that, shown in that equation. So if there's a three-point correlation function that involves two Fourier modes of the density field, and honestly, I don't know what the subscripts I on the deltas are for, so please ignore those. So delta of K1, delta of K2, and then there's an H sub P of capital K. That H sub P of capital K is the Fourier amplitude of whatever new field we're considering, a scalar, vector, or tensor field. And if it's a vector field, then that subscript P is one of the two polarizations that a vector field can have, say either the X polarization or the Y polarization if the Fourier mode is in the Z direction. And if it's a tensor field, then that P, that subscript P, can be a plus or a cross polarization for the gravitational wave. And geometrically, the three-point function for this can only depend on essentially a function of capital K in the magnitudes K1 and K2, which in this equation I've chosen to write as a power spectrum for the new field, P sub P of capital K, times some functional dependence on the Fourier amplitudes, Fourier wave numbers K1 and K2 for the density perturbations. And then next to that, there is a polarization tensor. And that polarization tensor is then dotted again into K1i and K2j. This is exactly the same as we saw for tensor fluctuations. But if we have a vector field, it's the same, except we just replace the epsilon ij by a polarization vector for a tensor for a vector field. Sorry, a polarization tensor for a vector field. And then again, there's the translation invariance-inducing Dirac delta function. So if we have such a three-point correlation function, so if there's some new scalar field that has a three-point correlation with the density perturbation, then if we look at some particular realization of this new field, H of K, which can be specified by a collection of Fourier amplitudes, H sub P of K, then as the equation at the bottom indicates, in the presence of some realization of this new field, which is specified by a set of Fourier coefficients, H sub P of K, there will be a two-point correlation induced between two Fourier modes of the density field that do not necessarily have the same wave number. So remember, if we have Gaussian fluctuations, then delta of K1 times delta of K2 is non-zero only if K1 is equal to K2. But if there is some new field, and suppose we consider one Fourier mode, H sub P of K, of that new field, then the coupling of that new field to the scalar field can induce an off-diagonal correlation between two Fourier modes of the density field, delta of K1 and delta of K2. And the off-diagonal correlation is going to be proportional to the amplitude of that Fourier mode. That's the H sub P of K1 plus K2. And remember, the Dirac delta function fixes K1 plus K2 to be equal to capital K. And then there is the dependence of that Fourier of the, sorry, there's the dependence on the wave vectors K1 and K2 given by that F sub P. And then there's the tensor epsilon IG peak dotted into the Fourier wave numbers K1 and K2 of the density perturbations. So what we're saying here is that there is an off-diagonal two-point correlation for the density field induced in the presence of some realization of the fossil field. Next slide, please. So let's look at the polarization tensor, which I've had on several previous slides. It's epsilon ij, and then P is the polarization. Epsilon ij is a symmetric 3x3 matrix, so most generally has six components, and those six components can be decomposed, as the table shows, into six different polarization states. So the first two are what we call 0 and z, and epsilon ij for the 0 polarization is just a Kronecker delta. That represents an overall scaling of the two-point correlation function. Actually, let me step back for a second. So in words, what happens is that if I have a Gaussian random field, then there's a two-point correlation function for the density field or the galaxy distribution, and that two-point correlation function is the same for all pairs of points that are separated by the same distance. So it's independent of the position in the universe that these two points are located at, and it's also independent of the orientation of those two points. However, if there is a departure from non-Gaussianity induced by coupling of the scalar field to some new scalar vector or tensor field, then the two-point correlation function for the density field will not necessarily be statistically isotropic if I look in a small patch of sky. There will be local departures from statistical isotropy. And those local departures from statistical isotropy are then characterized by these different polarizations. So if it's a scalar mode that's coupling to the inflaton, then the polarization can be either 0 or z. The 0 describes an overall scaling of the two-point correlation function from different points in the universe. So in one point in the universe, I might have Xi of R, and some other point of universe I'll have Xi of some other Xi of R. But the correlation, two-point correlation function will still depend only on R. Z denotes sort of a longitudinal variation of the two-point correlation function. Then the X and Y polarizations are the two vector polarizations, and those describe two-point correlation functions that are stretched in the X or in the Y direction. Actually, I have a picture in the next slide, but I'll get there in a second. And then the plus and the cross are the two transverse traceless polarizations. Those represent quadrupolar distortions to the two-point correlation function. And then if you look at the right describes the dependence of these polarization tensors on the azimuthal angle about the direction of propagation of the Fourier mode of the new field. So at the bottom of the page, there's a triangle that has a capital K. That capital K is the Fourier wave number for the new field, the scalar vector or tensor field. And then K1 and K2, the other two sides of the triangle, represent the Fourier wave numbers for the other two modes of the density field that are being correlated. And if that new field is a scalar field, then there's azimuthal symmetry of the space-time, there's an azimuthal symmetry of the effect of that scalar field about the direction of propagation. And so any triangle that has the same K1 and K2 will have the same three-point correlation function regardless of the value of phi. But if that capital K is the Fourier wave number for a vector field, then that vector field has associated with it a polarization vector that is oriented either in the X direction or in the Y direction, if that K is in the Z direction, in which case the three-point correlation function depends on the azimuthal angle of that triangle. So if I rotate the triangle by 90 degrees about that wave vector K, I will change, if I rotate it by 180 degrees, then I'll change the sign of that three-point correlation function I'll change the sign of the three-point correlation function. If it's a tensor perturbation, that capital K is a tensor mode, then there is a quadrupolar distortion about the direction of propagation. And if I rotate that triangle by 90 degrees about the direction of propagation of K, then I will change the sign of the of that tensor scalar three-point correlation function. So the scalar vector and tensor fields can be distinguished by the dependence of the three-point correlation function on that azimuthal angle about the particular Fourier mode that I'm considering. So that is the physics. And the next slide, which is slide 13, this has a picture. Actually, it's supposed to be a movie, but I couldn't get it to work. This is a picture of what the two-point correlation function would look like for the two gravitational wave polarizations plus and cross. So as we go from the bottom of the page to the top of the page, we're looking at the direction of the tensor mode, the direction of the gravitational wave, the direction of propagation of the gravitational wave. So we're looking at crests and troughs of the gravitational wave. And what you see is that you know what? I just noticed that this diagram is mislabeled. Actually, some of these things are misleading, so don't look at the circles. Look at the colored diagrams. So what you see there is that as you go along the Z direction, along the direction of propagation of gravitational wave, the two-point correlation function gets stretched first in the Y direction, and then later on, one period away, it gets stretched in the X direction. And H cross does the same thing, but rotated by 45 degrees. So again, look at the colored circles, not the colored spheres, not the circles. And then the next slide, which is slide 14, shows what happens with the two polarization states for the scalar mode, the zero and Z polarizations. So as we move along the direction of propagation, the two-point correlation function shrinks down and then gets expanded out a period later. And for the Z polarization, you see it looks like a sound wave. It's like a compressional mode for the two-point correlation function. And then the one that's a little less obvious is in the next slide, slide 15, The vector perturbation induces quadrupolar distortions to the two-point correlation function, but those quadrupolar distortions are oriented 45 degrees with respect to the direction of propagation of the gravity of the vector perturbation. And for the x polarization, that quadrupole goes in the xz direction, and for the y polarization, it goes in the yz polarization, although it's difficult to see in the diagram. So in the next slide, which is 16, we wrote down the estimator for the, so actually, so what we did in this paper is we actually showed how it is that you would look for these types of local departures from statistical isotropy. And it turns out that it's a very straightforward exercise that's directly analogous to the way that people look for the effects of weak gravitational lensing on the CMB. So if I have, if I'm looking for a particular new field, scalar vector tensor field, then I can consider each Fourier mode capital K independently. And then what I do is I want to measure the amplitude of that Fourier mode capital K. And the way I do that is I take all pairs of density Fourier modes, K1 and K2, that add up to that capital K. And the product of those two Fourier amplitudes, each product of those two Fourier amplitudes gives me an estimator for that H sub P of K, which is given by that formula there. And then it's straightforward to calculate the variance that each one of these individual estimators gives. And then I can write down the optimal or minimum variance estimator for each Fourier amplitude, H sub P of K, for this new field by summing over all those triangles with inverse variance weighting. And the formula is not given on this page, but it's given in the paper. And you therefore have a straightforward recipe. And the interesting part here is that there's this azimuthal dependence phi. So if I weight those different triangles equally for all phi, then I will be looking for a coupling to a scalar field. If I weight those triangles by a sine or cosine phi, then that estimator will seek out vector perturbations. And if I weight the estimator by cosine 2 phi or sine 2 phi, then that estimator will seek out only the tensor modes. So there is a way, not only a straightforward recipe to take a galaxy survey and not only look for coupling to a new field, but to geometrically distinguish whether that new field is a scalar vector or tensor. So next slide, please. So that's it for the B modes and galaxy surveys for now. That's it for how you search for these things. So now it's interesting to ask, especially in light of this BMO detection from BICEP2, can we look for these tensor fossils from single clock inflation? And there are interesting things that arise when you actually try to do this. So as I said before, this tensor scalar-scalar three-point correlation function arises even in single-field slow roll inflation. Oh yeah, so I'm reporting here on recent work by Yang Dai, Dongvi Jiang, and me, but there are also recent papers by Schmidt, Pyre and Zaldariaga that investigate similar things. And there's also some relevant papers by Jiang and Schmidt, and there are other papers as well. So anyway, what Dongvi and I did in that first paper is we took this three-point correlation function, the tensor scalar-scalar bispectrum from Maldacena's paper, and then we evaluated the amplitude of the observable. And we got infinity. So it turns out that if you naively evaluate Maldacena's formula, there's an infrared divergence, and you find that there's a power quadrupole that's infinite. In other words, the theory seems to predict that the amplitude of Fourier modes in the x direction is different than the amplitude of Fourier modes in the y direction by an infinite amount. And clearly, that's incorrect. It turns out that if you also consider a gravitational wave background and then ask how does that affect how does the lensing due to those gravitational waves affect observables? If you do that calculation naively, you find that lensing due to a scale invariant spectrum of gravitational waves leads to an infinite deflection angle, which again is a nonsensical result. And in this work, what we did, and what Fabian, Enrico, and Matthias have done, is shown that those two divergences cancel precisely. And in the work with Liang and Dongwei, we also not only showed that divergences cancel, but we also then calculated the finite residual power quadrupole. So single field slow roll inflation actually predicts that there is a power, a quadrupolar power asymmetry. The amplitude of Fourier modes in one direction, say the x direction, should be different than the amplitude of Fourier modes in the y direction by some calculable and in principle measurable amounts. So that's a new prediction of inflation that can, in principle, be tested. Next slide. So the obvious question is, are these signals detectable? And the answer is not anytime soon if standard single field slow roll inflation is the entire story. But I think they're still interesting to look for. These signals may be larger and maybe even far larger with models for beyond standard field single field slow roll inflation. And the other thing is that maybe in the distant future, we actually may be able to detect these single field slow roll tensor-scalar-scalar correlations. And this would be far future, but, you know, when we wrote these papers on B-modes 18 years ago, it seemed very, very, very far future. And to a first approximation, it was an academic exercise that we thought was interesting to work out. But it turns out that in a fraction of a lifetime later, looks like we may have actually seen them. So it's not necessarily premature to begin to think about the things that seem very futuristic today. So the next slide, 19, there's an equation on the top just to show you that the paper has equations. It has lots of them. This is essentially the central result. I'm not going to really tell you precisely what it means, but the thing on the left-hand side, that QIJ, is the power quadrupole. So it's the asymmetry in power, say, in the x direction versus the y direction for the density field. And it's related to the primordial gravitational wave amplitude. That's the gamma sub p, ij. That's actually the gravitational wave or the tensor fluctuation locally. And then the next term is an S sub n of k. And then there's a graph, and that graph, it shows a plot of that S of k as a function of k times eta, where a is the conformal time. So to give you a flavor for what's done in the paper, we consider an individual Fourier mode of the density field, and in standard linear perturbation theory, that just evolves according to some differential equations. But if there's a gravitational wave background, we consider one Fourier mode of the gravitational field with a wave number of capital K, then the growth of that density perturbation depends on the direction of that density Fourier mode with respect to the direction of the Fourier mode of the gravitational wave. And what you find is that early times, the Fourier mode is frozen. It has no effect on the growth of density perturbations, which is why that S is zero. And then around horizon crossing, then the gravitational wave starts to oscillate. And then that affects the growth of the density fluctuation. And then at late times, the gravitational wave amplitude decays, and so it has little further effect on the growth of the density perturbation. So what we really found here is that it's crucial to understand how the density perturbation is affected by the evolution of the gravitational wave around the time of horizon crossing for the gravitational wave. So the next slide, there's an equation on the top that actually comes from a paper by Brahma, Nelson, and Chandera that summarizes things that we worked out, that Fabian, Enrico, and Matthias worked out. Roughly speaking, in the squeeze limit, there's an observable bispectrum. That's a B sub P observed on the left-hand side. And that's equal to some primordial bispectrum, which is the B sub P, plus something else that describes, in some sense, late-time physics. And in single clock inflation, the two contributions cancel, and so you're left with a very small effect. But it's conceivable that in other scenarios that are not single clock inflation, like models like gauge inflation, chromonatural inflation, solid inflation, non-attractor inflation, particle string sources, etc., it's conceivable that this consistency relation is not satisfied. And if this consistency relation is not satisfied, it's conceivable that the observable power quadrupole predicted in these models could be considerably larger. So it's an interesting thing to look into. And at the bottom, there's a list of co-authors and collaborators that I have been discussing this with, and we are in the process of preparing papers, assembling notes, and preparing a paper. The next slide. So this is a brief description of another paper. So you might ask, if we have a tensor scalar-scalar three-point correlation function, what's the effect on the CMB? And the answer is that this tensor-scalar-scalar correlation induces a correlation between different spherical harmonic coefficients, ALMs, which in the absence of the correlation would be statistically independent. And those cross-correlations are described by these bipolar spherical harmonics, the capital A, JM sub L1, L2 on the right-hand side. And if you have tensor-scalar-scalar three-point correlation function that induces bipolar spherical harmonics with L1 plus L2 plus J that are odd, as opposed to a scalar-scalar-scalar three-point correlation function which only produces L1 plus L2 plus J equals even bipolar spherical harmonics. The next slide tells you that the standard prediction is probably too small to see. Again, it might be bigger in beyond single-field slow roll models. And, an interesting thing that you can say is that although L1 plus L2 plus L plus J equals odd is a signature for tensor fluctuations, it's also a signature for vector fluctuations. And although you can distinguish vectors from tensors with a three-dimensional galaxy survey map, you cannot distinguish them geometrically with a two-dimensional map. There's just not enough information. So in the last few minutes, I want to go back to CMB B-modes, which is the subject of discussion today. And I'm going to tell you a semi-crazy way to get B-modes with no temperature E-modes. And for now, it's probably just an academic exercise or mathematical curiosity, but some of you may find it interesting. So remind to you, as you've heard all day, R is about 0.2 from bicep 2, and Planck and WMF say R is less than 0.1, and so one has to ask what the fuss is all about. So it could be something else, maybe cosmic birefringence, topological defects. It's not so clear that these can work. There have been several papers, and collaborators and I are trying to assemble general arguments. Could it be running of the spectral index? Maybe something going on with the optical depth, the break in the power spectrum, neutrinos, some combination. So you heard about that from Kendrick this morning. But here's another possibility. So let's review what these E modes and B modes are. So there's a YLME and a YLMB, and then there are two subscripts, capital A and capital B, that are theta and phi. So these spherical harmonics, these are tensor spherical harmonics that are a complete set, a complete orthonormal basis for spin 2 fields that live on the sphere. And the point of these equations is to show that YLME can be obtained by application of derivative operators, which I summarize as WABE and WABB, applied to standard scalar spherical harmonics. So we can get these tensor E and tensor B spherical harmonics by applying the appropriate derivative operators to the scalar spherical harmonics. So next slide. So now let's go back to gravitational waves. Gravitational waves, a stochastic background of gravitational waves is a specific realization H sub AB of X. So H sub AB of X is a transverse traceless tensor field as a function of position. And usually we expand that in terms of plane waves, e to the I k dot x multiplied by polarization tensors for the two polarization states, s equals plus and s equals cross. And we do that for two reasons. So first of all, plane waves are a complete orthonormal set of basis functions for tensor fields in Euclidean space. And the second reason is that they're easy. Everybody knows how to do a Fourier transform. So next slide to show. So it shows you an alternative way that you can expand the tensor field. So alternatively, you can expand the tensor field in terms of total angular momentum waves. This was worked out in a paper that we wrote 2 years ago. So instead of expanding H sub B of X in terms of plane waves, you can expand it in terms of things that we call total angular momentum waves, which are those capital psi's. So there's a capital psi E and a capital psi B. And then H sub LME and H sub LMB are the amplitudes of those Fourier modes. They're specified by a wave number K, which you integrate over, and then total angular momentum quantum numbers L and M. And these are an alternative complete orthonormal set of basis functions for tensor fields. And specifically, they are transverse traceless tensor-valued eigenfunctions of the 3D Laplacian of eigenvalue minus k squared that are also eigenvalues of the total angular momentum and its azimuthal component. So the next slide shows what these are not. So just to clarify, these are not tensor spherical harmonics. Tensor spherical harmonics are basis, a set of basis vectors for tensors, sorry, basis, a complete basis for tensors that live on the two-sphere. And moreover, they are not the products of tensor spherical harmonics and radial eigenfunctions. So they're actually more complicated than just taking the tensor spherical harmonics and multiplying them by radial eigenfunctions. If you do that, then you do not actually wind up with a transverse traceless tensor field. But they can be projected onto the tensor spherical harmonics. So equation 28 shows you that it's straightforward to construct them. So just as tensor spherical harmonics can be obtained by applying derivative operators onto scalar spherical harmonics, these total angular momentum waves, these total angular momentum tensor waves can be written in terms of derivative operators applied onto this capital psi shown at the bottom, which is what we call the scalar total angular momentum wave. It's a spherical harmonic times a spherical Bessel function. Anyway, the equations in the middle, T sub AB to the capital B and T sub AB to the capital E, define the derivative operators that you use to obtain the tensor spherical harmonics from this, sorry, the tensor TAM waves from the scalar TAM waves. And there, capital D is essentially a gradient, capital K is essentially an angular momentum operator, and capital M is the cross product of those two. So this is a straightforward recipe to obtain this complete orthonormal set of basis functions, directly analogous to the way we obtain tensor spherical harmonics. So 29 gives you the punchline. So with this formalism, you can show that so with this formalism, any tensor field can be written as a sum of tensor B modes and tensor E modes. And what you can show is that the B mode of the total angular momentum wave gives rise only to B-mode CMB polarization without producing any E-mode or T fluctuation. And an E-mode of the tensor of the TAM wave gives rise to the CMB temperature and E-mode without producing any B-mode. So if by some construction or if in some way you can construct a tensor field that consists only of tensor modes, then you can actually have a tensor field that gives rise to CMB B modes without contributing anything at all to temperature fluctuations or E mode polarization. So that sounds great. The only drawback is given in the next slide, which is 30. So the problem is that you can show that E and B, the E and B tensor TAM waves, mix under a translation of the origin. So the difference in power between E and B tensor TAM waves can only arise if we occupy a preferred place in the universe. So if we postulate this as a solution to the discrepancy between bicep 2 and Planck and WMAP, then we're violating the Copernican principle. But still, I'm presenting it here because it might be of interest. Maybe it'll be a new ingredient if somebody has some other idea. Right now, I don't think this tension between 0.1 and 0.2 is so big to introduce such radical measures. But maybe, you know, if this tension continues, we might want to consider models that contain this as an ingredient. So before I close, the next slide, colleagues at Johns Hopkins, Chuck Bennett and Toby Marriage are pursuing an experiment called CLASS. And CLASS, I think, is a very important project to pursue now because it's one of the few projects that will complement BICEP, Keck, and most of the other suborbital missions by going to very large angular scales. So the obvious next step is to measure the B-mode power spectrum as a function of L. And most of the other missions are focused around L of 80, like BICEP 2. And CLASS is going to get all the way down to L of a few, to tens. So I think that's an important thing to do to complement what's being done with BICEP, Keck Array, and other experiments. So last slide is the last one. So to close, there's this disclaimer. Remember, extraordinary results require extraordinary scrutiny. BICEP 2 is as extraordinary as it gets, and so we really have to make sure that these results are confirmed before we leap to these dramatic conclusions that we seem to be leaping to. But either way, it indicates that the era of tensor science has arrived, and the obvious short-term goals, as we've heard about in previous talks, is that we need to verify the signal, and if verified, measure the BB power spectrum to the cosmic variance limit. We need large-angle experiments also, like Klass and Piper, and maybe a space-based mission to complement BICEP2, which peaks at L of 80 at the lower Ls, around the reionization bump. But in addition to considering what we should be doing right now in the immediate future, it's time to think about longer-term goals. What can we do in the 20-year horizon or beyond? And that's something that I tried to discuss today. I showed you that there may be things to think about in terms of large-scale structure probes for these tensor perturbations. There may be ways to test single-field slow roll inflation versus other models for inflation with these large-scale structure tests. There may be ways to search for new physics beyond standard single-field slow roll inflation with large-scale structure. We can also think about novel CMB tests. And the last slide is a hooray cheer for BBO and DESIGO, two of the most ambitious and imaginative and long-term things, but interesting and exciting, I believe. So thank you very much.
Okay, since we're a little over, I think maybe we have time for one question. Yeah.
Hi, Mark. If, going back to your scalar-scalar tensor three-point function contribution to the two-point scalar-scalar, if you are looking for an effect that is large enough to affect significantly the two-point constrained scalar-scalar two-point, then can you still assume isotropy in that calculation? And therefore, if you can't assume isotropy, you get a direct scalar tensor two-point contribution, which you should worry about more. Is that not true?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
If I'm breaking isotropy in the two-point function of the scalar-scalar so much that I see it, I mean, effectively, you're giving up isotropy, and therefore you'd get a tensor to scalar two-point correlation anyway.
That's what you're saying. That's a subtle question. I think the answer is no. So you've written papers about anisotropic universes. So if we actually have an anisotropic background, then the standard scalar vector tensor decomposition breaks down and those different modes decouple. What I'm surmising here is that we have an isotropic and homogeneous background, but then we superimpose on it perturbations in the standard way, which we decompose.
But then your signal is really small. But if it's large enough, that just intuitively just tells me that effectively you're in an isotropic background if you're perturbations at the two-point level look anisotropic. And then I'd worry about a tensor scalar two-point.
I don't know. I mean, the way I think about
it, you're breaking up, so your answer is a bit confused. I'm clearly right, so...
All right, well, he may not be able to hear us, but let's give another round of applause to Mark. Oh.